Hello and welcome to Talking Tudors, a fortnightly podcast about the ever-fascinating Tudor dynasty. My name is Natalie Gruniger and I'll be your host and guide on this journey through 16th century England. Are you ready to step through the veil of time into the dazzling and dangerous world of the Tudor court? Without further ado, it's time to talk Tudors. Hello everyone, welcome back to Talking Tudors episode 18 and the first instalment for 2019. I'm your host, Natalie Gruniger, and joining me today to talk all things Henry VIII is Tracy Borman. Tracy studied and taught history at the University of Hull and was awarded a PhD in 1997. She went on to a successful career in heritage and has worked for a range of historic properties and national heritage organisations, including the Heritage Lottery Fund, the National Archives and English Heritage. She's now Chief Executive of the Heritage Education Trust, a charity that encourages children to visit and learn from historic properties through the Sanford Award Scheme. Tracy is also Joint Chief Curator for Historic Royal Palaces, the charity that manages, among other sites, Hampton Court Palace and the Tower of London. Tracy often appears on television and radio and is a regular contributor to history magazines, notably BBC History. My conversation with Tracy straight after this short musical break, courtesy of guitarist John Sales. Welcome to Talking Tudors, Tracy. How are you?
I'm very well. It's nice to be part of this.
Oh, I'm so excited to have you on the show. Do you mind just telling our listeners a little bit about yourself and your background?
Sure. So I am a Tudor historian. I've written a number of books on the Tudor period. And when I'm not writing books, I am Joint Chief Curator of Historic Royal Palaces. So fabulous. I'm currently sitting in Hampton Court Palace, I like to call it my office, but it's kind of several other people's offices as well. But it's obviously a total joy for a Tudor historian to have Hampton Court as their workplace.
Wow. I know it's not good to be jealous, but I am a little bit envious right now that you're sitting in Hampton Court. That's fantastic. And so what sparked your interest in the Tudors?
Do you know, it goes back to when I was doing my A-levels. Mm-hmm. So in the UK, that's sort of at the age of 16 to 18. And I had the most amazing teacher, Mrs. Jones, who inspired me with a complete fascination with the Tudors. She really brought the characters of those monarchs to life for me. And I think her great gift was just to make me realize they're human beings. Mm. You know, we're not just talking about great political events and being motivated by politics and all that kind of thing. It's about human beings. Absolutely. And stories. And yep. She brought it to life like nobody else. And it also helped that she had amazing Holbein reproductions around the classroom. So it was just like stepping back into the Tudor world.
Wow, how fabulous. And, you know, a few of the people that I've spoken to have mentioned that their teachers did sort of ignite their love of the Tudors and history. And I think, isn't that wonderful what a really great teacher can do?
Oh, it's so powerful. Honestly, so many people that I've spoken to as well say that their love of history began with a teacher. So what power and what influence for those teachers to have. It's just amazing.
Absolutely. I love that. Now, Tracy, you're the author of a number of highly acclaimed books, including The Private Lives of the Tudors. Could you talk to us a little bit about what this book's about and what inspired you to write it?
Yes, The Private Lives really was inspired by my work for Historic Royal Palaces because we like to tell visitors about the architecture of the palaces and the events that took place here and some of the more famous things that that the palace is known for. But actually, increasingly, what I was finding is that visitors were asking questions that we couldn't answer, and it was much more fundamental kind of questions, like, why did Henry VIII go to the toilet? How did they wash their clothes? And what did they use for makeup? So it was those kind of nitty-gritty questions that really got me thinking, actually, I need to know more about this myself. And is there a whole other side to the Tudors that we're just not telling? Their private side, the side that probably they wouldn't have wanted us to have seen. And I was just intrigued from that moment forward. So that's really the premise for the book. What are the Tudors like? If you could follow them behind closed doors to their private apartments, what do they look like without their makeup? What are their habits, disgusting or otherwise? How do they spend their time? And it was absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, I loved it. I actually listened to it on Audible, and and now I need to buy a hard copy book, because I was just I was trying to walk and power walk whatever, you know, a few seconds. I was like, oh my god, I need to remember this. I need to note this down. So it was actually, I think I've learnt my lesson to only listen to fiction while I'm walking, and you know, save my nonfiction for books. Yeah, but it was fantastic. I loved all the as you say, the nitty gritty and the details, because it really does bring them to life, and they become suddenly much more human, obviously, when we're talking about these sorts of things. Now, Tracy, privacy is something obviously that's highly valued in our modern society, but I was wondering if you might maybe could speak to us about this concept as it relates to the Tudor monarchs, maybe touching on how the architecture of their palaces actually reflected this growing desire for private, more private spaces.
Yes, absolutely. The privacy was mapped out in every single palace, because the Tudors built their palaces to enhance their personal magnificence, but also to increase their privacy when required. So at the heart of every Tudor palace were the privy chambers or private apartments of the king or queen. And not just anybody could go in there, of course. The more highly favoured you were, the higher status, the more likely it was that you would get invited into that inner sanctum. But most people only made it to the rooms adjoining. And there was a very strict order of precedence at the Tudor court. The closer you were allowed to the privy chamber, the more important you were. You couldn't just go into any room at court. And so that's really how the Tudors used their palaces to enhance that message about their privacy. And I think what they really understood, and probably more than certainly later monarchs, is the importance of privacy. Just keeping something back, having an air of mystery around yourselves, not giving too much away. I think that was their real genius.
Absolutely. And how amazing that, you know, you work in Hampton Court and you can kind of just imagine all that went on in the various chambers. That is absolutely fantastic.
Now, it's a joy.
Now, while researching the private lives of the Tudors, did you discover anything that surprised you or maybe even made you question some of your longstanding beliefs about this particular period?
Yes, I did. Particularly around Henry VIII, who obviously has gone down in history as this stridently self-confident, even tyrannical monarch. But in private, he is so different. He was described by one visitor to his privy chamber as being the most timid man you could hope to meet. And the reason for that remark, which is quite astonishing, that Henry was a hypochondriac. He was absolutely paranoid about sickness and disease. And while he tried to conceal that from the rest of the court, when he was in private, this obsession really came out. He had his own private medicine cabinet. He was examined by his physicians every single day. He was always having his horoscope cast, because in those days you would have your horoscope cast to find out what sorts of illnesses you needed to look out for in future. He was a very, very different Henry to the one that I thought I knew.
Yeah, that is absolutely fascinating. I would never have sort of, you know, used the word timid to describe him.
No.
That's for sure. That's really interesting. Now, your latest nonfiction book is called Henry VIII and the Men Who Made Him, and I've got it here and I can't wait to dive into this one. Why did you feel that it was important to sort of look at Henry through the eyes of his male advisors? advisors and the servants around him?
Well, because I've studied the Tudors for many years now, yeah, I'm always looking for a new perspective. And so with Henry, of course, there have been many biographies of this most famous king, arguably England's most famous king.
Yeah.
But always, really, from the perspectives of the wives, because that's why he is famous, because he marries six times and no other king has done that in our history. And so we've become a little bit obsessed with those wives, and it did make me think, what about the other half of the story?
That's right. What about
the men in Henry's life? How will he appear if we look at him through their eyes? And actually the answer to that was quite fascinating, quite surprising. He emerges as somebody altogether more complex than that one-dimensional, much-married tyrant that we think we know. And I was going to say love, but maybe that's not the word.
It's a kind of love-hate relationship, isn't it, with Henry?
Yeah.
And I was wondering maybe if you'd delve into that a little bit more. Like, what do Henry's relationships with the men that surrounded him kind of reveal about his character and personality?
He does come across as a more sympathetic character, somebody capable of intense loyalty, abiding loyalty. Of course, we hear when the relationships go wrong, the likes of Thomas Cromwell and Cardinal Wolsey both fell foul of Henry after serving him for years.
Absolutely.
But there were other quieter relationships that did endure. Henry's long-standing friend, William Compton, his best friend, Charles Brandon. All of these friendships were hugely important to Henry. He stood by those childhood companions, and they served him for the rest of his days and their days too. And really, you do see that Henry is a man who thrives on affectionate, close relationships. He's not just the fickle monster that we know more about, I think.
Yeah, that's really wonderful. I look forward to sort of getting that perspective on, you know, on him as well. And in all, you've done, as you said, a lot of research into the Tudors. So out of the many misconceptions that exist about Henry VIII, what do you think is one of the worst or one of the most, I suppose, persistent?
I think it is just that he was a tyrant. I don't really like that word applied to him anymore, even though I have, you know, for quite a while thought that it was justified.
Yeah.
I think Henry actually was heavily manipulated, certainly in his later years when he was increasingly paranoid and suspicious and quite insecure. He was very easy to manipulate by the likes of the Duke of Norfolk and Stephen Gardiner. And you really see how they're just playing with Henry. They persuade him to do things that further their own interests, but that really aren't in the interests either of the king or of the country. So I actually found myself feeling quite sorry for Henry. Yes, of course, he's capable of acts of brutality and ruthlessness, but you have to look at him in the context of the age. It is a very brutal age. The Tudor court, of course, is one of the most dangerous places you could be. So Henry is part of that. But I think I was just so astonished by how much he allowed himself to be manipulated by the men who surround him.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Now, you mentioned sort of later in his reign, but do you think he was always kind of easily manipulated, even from young, from his...
I think he was. I think he had quite a charming naivety about him. And he wanted to believe the best in people, or to find the best in people. And he certainly had that in childhood. He was a very gregarious, fun-loving young man, very trusting in his relationships. And so that's a quality that was with him really from birth. And I guess because he was the spare heir for much of his childhood, he wasn't exposed to the same kind of political environments as he would have been had he been heir to the throne all along. But that only happened when he was 11, when his elder brother Arthur died, and he was suddenly now the sole heir of the Tudor dynasty. And he had to kind of wise up. But I would say it was almost too late. His character was pretty much set by then.
Yeah. Wow. He's suddenly appearing much more human now as you speak, which is fantastic.
Yes, good.
Yeah, good. Which is what we want, exactly. Now, 2018, Tracy, was such a big year for you because it was also saw the release of your first novel, so The King's Witch. Now, is this something you've always wanted to do, to write fiction?
You know, it is, because when I'm not writing history, I'm reading historical fiction. So right. I just absolutely love it. I'm a devotee of the likes of Alison Weir, Hilary Mantel, mm-hmm. C.J. Sansom. I just cannot get enough of historical fiction. And it's been a long-held dream of mine to actually write fiction myself. And so it was such a thrill to be able to do it. Now, it does feel vaguely treasonous that I chose the Stuarts as yes. my subject, being a Tudor historian. But my novel does at least open with familiar territory, and it opens with the death of Elizabeth I. So it's that very turbulent period. Mm. The Tudors are over. We have a new dynasty. It's not a well-liked dynasty. And bubbling up under the surface is religious dissent, leading to the literally explosive gunpowder plot. And that really is the inspiration for this novel. But it was a complete dream come true for me to be able to write fiction.
Absolutely amazing. And it's, you know, what a fantastic thing you've done. And I'm just thinking that might be a good one for me to listen on Audible, I hope. Then I won't have to stop take too many notes. Maybe. I was going to say, so why didn't you focus your novel in the Tudor period? Why did you want to do it in the later period?
Well, I think what I'm hoping is that I haven't forever abandoned the Tudors in a fictional sense. It's just that actually for my first novel, I was very conscious that there are many, many novels about the Tudors. Yeah. And I just thought, actually, what about the end of the Tudor period? It has always fascinated me, that transfer of power from the Tudors to the Stuarts, and what followed and the turbulence that followed. And so I thought, I've still got a slight foot in the Tudors,
that's right.
so to speak, but I'll just take us a little bit further on into the early Stuart period. And it really is a dark and fascinating time.
Wow. And is this a period you were interested in prior, or was this kind of new alien territory for you?
Yeah. The other inspiration really for the book is that I wrote a non-fiction history book about the witch hunts and about James the First and his role in that, because he was absolutely obsessed right. with the idea of witches. He saw himself as appointed by God to hunt them down, to rid the kingdom of their presence. And so that was just so disturbing, actually. A lot of the research I did that, and I did feel the need to kind of make it more immediate by fictionalizing some of it, having my heroine, as I do, as a suspected witch, and just conveying the terror that these women must have felt when they found themselves accused of something they couldn't have been guilty of.
No,
of course. Even if they themselves had tried to practice sorcery, of course there was no such thing. And so in many, many cases, in most cases, they had done literally nothing wrong. It was just a way of putting women down, of settling neighborly disputes.
Yeah, that's right.
It was quite a vicious society. So, of course, again, perfect hunting ground for dramatic fiction.
Absolutely. And I know I've read some of the reasons why people were accused of it, and it's just so terrifying that it could have happened, obviously, to any of us, for the most, absolutely. You know, minor reasons. And I recently went to the States, and I visited Salem, which obviously has all the witch connections. And it's quite a powerful, moving place. And when you start reading the stories of the individual women that were executed, you just think, oh, my goodness, it's just scary, scary stuff. Well, that sounds fantastic. I cannot wait to read your novel, Tracy. It sounds so good.
Oh, thank you. I hope you'll enjoy it.
Oh, I think I will. I think lots of people will. Now, what is a day in the life of a chief curator or joint chief curator of historical palaces like? Because it just sounds like, to me, it just sounds like, oh my goodness, this is the dream job for us Tudor history nuts. So what's it entail? What's it like?
Well, you know what? I don't know if there is such a thing as a typical day, because...
Right, every day's day, yep.
So if I were to choose, if I kind of average out my activities and make up a day, of course there are meetings and there are emails like any other job. But what I do quite a lot of is media work. So this very morning, I was up very early, and I've just come from the Great Hall, where I have taken part in some filming for a new documentary about palaces. Right. And so I do quite a lot of filming, both for historic royal palaces and, of course, privately as well. I give talks. I do research now and again, although not nearly enough, I have to say. I would love to do more research. But one thing that I am so lucky to be doing at the moment is leading a really big project here at Hampton Court Palace to open up some of the Tudor spaces that have never been open to the public.
Wow, and we this do is have incredible.
Some quite amazing space. You'd think that they were all open, but they're really not.
And no, I know, and I've always spaces. Wanted to get into the room. I think it's on the third level, isn't it, that's closed off.
Yes.
Will that be open to the public, will it?
Yeah, we're working towards it very hard. I mean, there are reasons why these rooms haven't been open. The access isn't great. We've got to think about fire safety and all the rest of it. So it's not something we can just throw the doors open and say, come and look at this room. Yeah. But if we're patient, then we will be giving visitors something incredibly special in the years to come. What I'm hoping is that we'll be able to open at least part of Henry VIII's Privy Chamber, because believe it or not, that has never been open. And of course, it's the one thing visitors ask more than anything else, where's Henry's bedroom?
Absolutely.
And so we're hoping to be able to do that, but also that room where Jane Seymour gave birth to the future Edward VI, and where she died a few days later. It's a magnificent room. There's an amazing fireplace there. But of course, the rooms are much altered. They have been repurposed over the centuries that have followed. So our aim would be to return them to their original Tudor splendour.
Wow, you have absolutely made my day, and I will make the grueling 21-hour flight from Sydney to see that when it opens. I can tell you that right
goodness.
Now.
Please do.
How many years do I have to save up, Tracy? Do I have a few years, a couple of years? What do I?
Well, you've probably got about 5 years.
Five years. Okay, that's fine.
Not going to happen overnight.
I'm sure I'll visit beforehand anyway, but I'll come then as well, of course. That is really, really exciting, because I know that when I go with my little maps and walk around Hampton Court, of course, you know, there's obviously spaces that we can't enter or spaces that are gone. So that is tremendously exciting. Yeah. What a great project.
It's a huge privilege to be involved. It's probably the most exciting thing that's happened at Hampton Court for many, many years. So as a Tudor historian, it kind of doesn't get any better than that.
No, that is fantastic. So watch this space, everyone, I think, is the message
there.
Excellent. Now, Tracy, over the centuries, obviously, many people have reported some odd goings on at the Tower of London and at Hampton Court. I know that I've been running my blog for almost 10 years, and I've received so many emails and messages from people, you know, sending me photos, or saying, you know, this is what happened at this certain spot. Have you ever experienced anything strange?
Well, I have. Not as often as you might think, given how many hours I spend in the palace when it's dark and when there are no visitors around. Yeah. But I was once actually on a ghost tour with Alison Weir, very good friend, and obviously huge inspiration as a historian. And we both love a good ghost story. And we were walking along the Haunted Gallery, no less, at Hampton Court, where Catherine Howard's unquiet spirit is said to run screaming now and again. And of course, I've always completely dismissed that tale because, in fact, Catherine Howard didn't run along the Haunted Gallery trying to reach Henry VIII.
No,
but that's the tale. Anyway, we got halfway along the Haunted Gallery and they turned off all the lights just to increase the atmosphere. And all of a sudden, both Alison and I felt this really icy cold draft coming from behind us.
Okay.
And we were both a bit terrified. Mm. And they put the lights on and we turned around expecting to see an open window. It was a solid wall. There was nowhere that draft could have come from. It was just a very definite draft, a very definite lowering of temperature. And we still talk about that. This is several years ago, but we both felt it. I can't explain it.
It's
Catherine Howard, we don't know. But I think it was something of a supernatural nature, I think.
Oh, I absolutely love it. Look, I absolutely love a good ghost story. It's one of my favorite things. And I love when something like that happens that you can't really explain. And a lot of the people that have gotten in touch with me, it has been about that particular area that you're talking about, even though we know, like you said, that, you know, Catherine obviously didn't run up there, but there still seems to be something going on in that space. And you know, there's such an atmosphere, isn't there, there?
Oh, completely. There really is. You can't escape the atmosphere, even if you're a complete non-believer. And we have many of those here, complete skeptic.
Yeah, yeah.
I keep an open mind, actually. I love a good ghost story.
Yeah.
And I would love to have more experiences. Maybe I shouldn't say that, actually.
Yeah. But, careful what you ask for, Tracy.
Exactly. But I know we do get many skeptics here, but even they really can't deny the evidence that we have for some of our more ghostly happenings. I think it's fascinating.
I love it. And anything at the Tower?
Oh, gosh, there are many things at the Tower, but nothing that I've personally experienced, to my disappointment, because I spend a lot of time there.
Yeah.
But that, of course, because of the very violent history of the Tower, you might expect there are ghost stories involving Anne Boleyn and Catherine Howard again, and many of the other prisoners who met their fate at the Tower. Probably one of my favourites is a yeoman warder who claimed late at night at Christmas in 1830, he claimed that he had seen the ghost of Mary, Queen of Scots, on top of the White Tower. Now, his claim was based on his assumption that Mary, Queen of Scots, was executed at the Tower, where, of course, she was executed at Fotheringay.
That's
so
right.
I think that was a figment of his imagination.
He was a little confused.
I'm
with
not
his
sure
facts.
Why Mary would have been roaming the Tower.
No. I love the there's lots of good Victorian tales about the Tower, and and I love that they're my favourite. Now, were you at working at, I'm just trying to remember when it was, at Hampton Court, there was that film, which you probably recall, where the doors opened and it kind of looked like Henry decided to say hello.
It did look like, I was working here then, but I'm afraid I had no knowledge of that. You know, I didn't see that apart from seeing the CCTV, it certainly convinced many of our warding staff, because it wasn't one of our costumed interpreters. We know that it wasn't an area of the palace that they would have been allowed to get into or able to get into. So that remains a rather enticing prospect.
It is quite amazing.
If your listeners want to look it up on YouTube, I think it's still there. We call him Skeletor, the ghost on CCTV at Hampton Court.
Yeah, it's pretty fantastic footage, I have to say. And I was just thinking, if any of our listeners want to get in touch with their stories that may have happened at Hampton Court or the Tower, I know I'd love to hear them. And I think, Tracy, you might like to hear them as well.
Oh, yes, definitely.
Since we're both ghost story lovers. Now, are you currently working on any new Tudor books at the moment? Or
I'm working currently on my sequel to the novel. So The King's Witch is a trilogy. So that is next up, and then the third and final book will probably follow straight after that. So the second book is out next year, the third book in 2020. But then my next non-fiction is absolutely Tudor, and I am returning to one of my most favourite subjects, Elizabeth.
Oh, fantastic.
So watch this space. I can't quite reveal the angle I'm taking, but suffice it to say, it's Elizabeth as we've never seen her before.
Oh, this is exciting. So much exciting stuff going on. I can't wait. Excellent. Now, Tracy, I could talk to you all day, but I imagine that you've probably got some work to do.
I've got a few meetings and boring stuff now, but this has been the most fun part of my day, so thank you.
Thank you. But are we okay to play a little game of 10 to go? So just some 10 quick questions. All right. So what was the last film that you saw?
The last film I saw was, goodness me, it was Bohemian Rhapsody.
I haven't seen that yet. Did you enjoy it?
I mean, you don't mean historical film, just general film.
No, just any film,
I'm a big Queen fan. I loved it.
It looks great, and I've seen some very good reviews. Name an item that's on your bucket list.
On my bucket list, oh, goodness me, I would like to go to Seville, and it might not sound a very adventurous thing to have on a bucket list. You know, it's
Seville.
A place I could easily go to, but it seems to have remained out of my reach for many years, and people keep going and telling me how amazing it is and how incredible the history is.
It is amazing.
So Seville is top of my bucket list.
I visited a few years back, and I loved the whole of Spain, but that's particularly wonderful, and historic.
Great.
What's an early childhood memory that you've got?
An early childhood memory. Well, you're going to think that I'm just making this up, but it's visiting historic houses, and one house in particular, Belton House. So I'm from Lincolnshire, which is in the kind of middle of England, and Belton House is a beautiful kind of 17th, 18th century house. And I remember visiting with my sister and just getting that kind of shivers down the spine moment, even though I was probably only about 8 or 9. And I just thought, there's something about these old places I want to know more about. And
that's fantastic.
All started there, really.
Oh, love it. And while we're on the talking childhood, what was a favourite childhood book of yours?
Favourite childhood book? has to be actually the Box of Delights. Uh-huh. So I don't know if I'm just influenced by the fact it's kind of Christmas time and it's seasonal, but the Box of Delights by John Masefield, and I still read it. I used to read it every Christmas as a child, and I still do. I absolutely love it.
That sounds lovely. I like that. And what's one of the books that you're currently reading? You're probably reading lots of others. But
yeah. One of the books I'm currently reading is Alison Weir's novel on Anne Boleyn.
Oh, yes.
So obviously she's working her way through the Six Wives. The next one out is Anne of Cleves, which is who's my favourite wife, so I'm looking forward to that one. But the Anne Boleyn novel so far is absolutely gripping.
Fabulous. Thank you. Good recommendation. What's a favourite holiday destination?
Oh, Venice. Every time. I don't even hesitate.
Yeah, you were really quick
with that. I would very, very happily holiday in Venice. Every single time I go on holiday. I lived there for 6 weeks while I was studying conservation in Venice, and I completely fell in love with the place, and I just feel at peace when I go back to Venice. And you know what, it's been 2 years since I've been, and I'm getting withdrawal symptoms, so it's about time I rebooked.
Yeah, it's overdue then. That's what happens to me when I don't visit Hampton Court for a while. It sort of lures me back and calls me back, come back. What's a new skill that you'd like to learn?
A new skill, probably I would like to learn ballroom dancing.
Oh.
Because I am a massive Strictly fan. Strictly Come Dancing, I absolutely love. I'm slightly sad that the series is over now. But every week I watch it, I think, my God, I would just love do that. I would probably have two left feet and be awful, but I would love to do it.
That sounds fun. I like it. What was your first paid job?
My first paid job was as a paper girl. I delivered newspapers, and you know what? I stuck at that job. Oh, how many years?
That's great.
Probably about 10 years because, you know, I started when I was 11. Believe it or not, I still did it when I was at university, kind of in the holidays sometimes. Yeah. I helped out.
Yeah.
So, that was my very glamorous first paper.
Yeah, I don't think we've had that one in all the episodes, so that's great. Fabulous. What's a really great piece of advice that somebody's given you or that you've heard somewhere along the line?
A great piece of advice. Well, I'm going to talk about the context of working in history.
Because yes,
it's
please.
The piece of advice that stuck with me, and that is to volunteer and to just get your face and your name out there, meet people who are doing the same thing as you would like to do.
Yeah.
And there's no substitute for it, even in this age of kind of digital media where you can tweet people. You can't beat just meeting somebody and making that contact, and volunteering somewhere is an excellent way to do that.
That's fantastic advice, really great. And lucky last question, what characteristics do you most value in others?
I think loyalty,
yes,
steadfastness, and as my dad always says, doing what you say you're going to do, which sounds really straightforward, but it's surprising how many people don't do what they say they're going to do. And so I think that one above all is one that I really cherish.
Oh, that is so true. Now, before I let you run away, Tracy, what's your Tudor takeaway? So a little gem for us to explore after our episode.
Yeah. My Tudor takeaway is this, my favourite fact of all time, which is that Elizabeth I had her famous astrologer, Dr. John Dee. But what we don't know so much about Dee is that he was also her spy. He was often sent on foreign missions, and he would write back to Elizabeth in code. And do you know what his code name was? It was 007.
Oh, that is so cool.
And I just think, how incredible is that?
That is
incredible.
So somewhere
along the way, that fact has influenced James Bond, and I love it.
I love that. That's a really cool takeaway. Really like that. Very different. I love it. Tracy, thank you so much. I can't thank you enough for making time in your super busy day to chat with me.
It's been a pleasure. I've absolutely loved it. Always happy to talk Tudors.
Oh, excellent. I know. I need to. I'm so happy that I have this outlet now, because my poor husband's, you know, eyes would just roll into the back of his head when I'd start chatting about the Tudors again.
I know the feeling.
Poor thing. So I think he's very pleased with it as well. All right. Well, thank you so much. I hope you have a really wonderful day.
And you too. Thanks, Matt.
Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Talking Tutors. Thank you so much for listening. If you have any comments or suggestions or just want to say hi, please get in touch with me via my website www.onthetutortrail.com, where you will also find show notes for today's episode. If you've enjoyed the show, please share the podcast with friends and family and click on the all-important follow button so you'll never miss an episode. I also invite you to join our Talking Tutors podcast group on Facebook, where you can interact with other tutor history lovers and hear all the behind-the-scenes news. It's time now for us to re-enter the modern world. As always, I look forward to talking tutors with you again very soon.